very awkward organizational arrangement and something that I don't think the Canadian Navy could be terribly proud of. However, by a lot of hard work and goodwill, we got the job done. The other frustrating thing was that the ship was being built at Harold Wolff's, the biggest shipyard in the world, staffed by something like 25,000 Irishmen, who were delightful people, promise you anything that you ask them to promise, but not necessarily with immediate intent of carrying the promises out.
Sounds Irish, all right.
And so it was just a constant round of meetings to try to find out why something some job hadn't been got on with, and we were always assured that, well, don't worry, it'll be all right on the day, but when the day would come, there was nothing done, then we'd have to start over again. So to make a long story short there, the ship was delayed several months, but I think it was only maybe 3 or 6 months longer than the original completion date. But it was a constant battle of wits to try and get it completed on time. Life was very pleasant there, though, and except that you could never get away on a holiday because of this constant need for surveillance. And with several thousand workmen pouring aboard a ship every day, there was an awful lot of inspection to be done by the Canadians, and so we needed our full team there all the time. Again, once we got the ship built, then there was 3 or 4 months of trials, trying everything under the sun in UK waters. And then it was a question of trying to keep the contractor's personnel from disappearing off the ship every time you went anywhere near land. Because trials were always being postponed and delayed, and we had 40 or 50 representatives of various contractors living on board to sort of be there when their piece of equipment was tried. But the moment there was any breakdown or delay, they were off like rabbits out of the ship. And
you had to gather them all up again,
Yeah, had to gather them up again, and I spent more time on the radio telephone, I think, trying to get people sent back to the ship who had disappeared overnight than enough. Because we were never very, we always anchored at night, and there were boats going back and forth. And we had no real authority to tell these people to stay on board or not to stay on board. But we got the ship finished and tested and tried, and the aircraft squadrons, a few aircraft of each type, were sent over, and we did very successful trials. I remember the CO of the Banshee squadron, of the test section of the Banshee squadron, was a Lieutenant Commander Bob Falls, who until recently was the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and
gone
to Brussels. And he in those days was Lieutenant Commander.
You flew on your aircraft in Ireland, did you?
In UK waters,
UK,
And the tracker aircraft the same, and we did all sorts of trials, trying out the steam catapult and so on. We did the trials first of all with dummies and then with real airplanes, and eventually got everything working well. And we sailed for Halifax in the summer of 1957. Can't remember the date, but I do remember that we were about halfway across the Atlantic when the election was held, and when we arrived, Mr. Diefenbaker was the Prime Minister. When we left Ireland, it had been Mr. Mackenzie King, I guess. Pearson.
Pearson,
yeah. So I stayed in the ship for another year after that, in operating off Halifax.
You were the chief. You were the chief.
I was the chief engineer.
Engineer officer,
it's called. Yeah.
Yeah.
Commander E.
Those
days. And then in summer of 1958, I was appointed to Ottawa again, and went back to much the same job as I'd had before, but by this time it was called something else. Director of Engineering, Facilities and Machine Design, I think it was this time.
Going back to the Bonaventure, You had her for the first year of her service life. Were there any particular problems developed at that time? Perhaps due to the weather conditions, the cold of Halifax or the heat of the Caribbean, where presumably you went? And anything?
Yeah, can I just break for a minute before I...
Okay, we're back again.
Well, we always seem to be having problems in any ship that I've ever served in, but looking back on it 20 or 25 years later, I can't remember
anything
that was beyond the wit of man to solve.
Yeah.
Any trips or cruises that we went on were fairly successful. We did a lot of exercising in the Atlantic off Halifax with British submarines and American submarines, some of our own HMC ships, tanker, and so on. And seemed to do an awful lot of flying.
Mm-hmm.
Night flying still, I think, would still scare hell out of me. Watching those Banshee airplanes, which were a high-performance jet, landing in the dark with the lights all turned out on a postage stamp-sized deck, made me think that anybody who was fool enough to go into the air branch, you know, should have a keeper.
Yeah.
But there were some very very stable and very mature people among them, and they were very workmanlike in their performance. And
obviously good flyers.
Obviously very good flyers, and it was very sad when they phased the Naval Aviation branch out of being, in effect, when they got rid of a carrier eventually and had no ships capable of carrying fixed-wing airplanes after that. Nowadays, we have only helicopters at sea.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, how big a complement in the engineer department would there be in a ship that size?
Well, I've forgotten the number, but it was something like 220 or 250. It was of that order.
Quite a number,
though. And about 50 of those were assigned to flight deck type of duties, aviation fuel, looking at operating the catapult, fueling the air, helping to fuel the airplanes, and so on. And they weren't the only people who were helping service the airplanes. The flight deck the crew themselves, that is the airman side of the flight deck, had quite a crew too of aircraft handlers. But my people were just responsible for manufacturing oxygen and so on for the pilots, providing the fuel, storing the fuel, getting it to the aircraft on time, operating the catapult, operating the arrestor gear, the arrestor wires. A lot of this was automatic, but it still had to have people standing by.
Yeah, right. What would your engine room staff be on a typical watch? One or two officers and...
Usually had one engineer officer on the watch and usually an assistant who was somebody under training. But only one required on watch. But of course, when we were at flying stations, a lot more people had to show up and be on duty while we were actually flying aircraft on and off, which was not really a large percentage of the time. But we always had one or two newly entered sub-lieutenants who acted as a second officer of the watch. But operating the main machinery of an aircraft carrier wasn't all that difficult. The machinery was, in effect, not a lot different from the destroyer machinery of World War II, you know, the tribal class destroyer.
Same but bigger.
Just the same but bigger,
yeah.
But the main difference in an aircraft carrier is all the household machinery that you get, you know, just things that have nothing to do with the propulsion of the ship.
A lot of pumps and things
pumps
like that.
Pumps and heating equipment and
fans
and oxygen-making equipment and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The aviation fuel, storing high-octane gasoline in a ship is a pretty hazardous thing.
Yeah.
You have some very special protective tanks which are surrounded by an inert gas, and we have to manufacture the inert gas to fill these spaces and that sort of thing.
Hmm.
But No, I don't think there's an awful lot more to be said about Bonaventure, except that I can probably jump several years ahead to the famous Bonaventure refit, which occurred 10 or a dozen years, I suppose, after I left the ship. And that was a real tragedy. And the tragedy was this, that the ship needed the refit, and the work that was done was work that needed to be done, and it did extend or would have extended the life of the ship for quite a while. The government did get value for the money spent. The problem was that the money spent was a different amount of money than had been intended. And there were some real comedy of errors along the way. But basically, the ship was being refitted under a fixed cost-plus contract, same as I had been mentioning earlier, which works out all right. So the contractors didn't get paid for anything that they didn't do. So it wasn't as though, to use the modern expression, the government was ripped off at all. There wasn't any rip-off. But a lot of the things that were done were not very clearly specified at all. And some of the things that were specified weren't done. I don't mean by that there was anything essential left out. But under the rather ridiculous system that we had of having a Department of National Defense and a Department of Defense Production jointly responsible for the contracting and the refitting of a ship, you had the left hand quite often not knowing what the right hand was doing. And although I had nothing whatever to do with the Bonaventure refit, I was in a job that was fairly close to those who did have something to do with it, and so I was able to see what was going on. And I think the thing that got everybody unstuck, and as you know, there was a parliamentary committee investigated the incident, and what they discovered was that the breakdown of costs that had been provided to the Treasury Board when they approved the money for the contract was a very fictitious breakdown. In other words, the project officer for the Department of Defense Production, whose job it was to prepare a submission to go to the Treasury Board to get the money, had on the one hand a list of things that the ship said had to be done, and on the other hand he had a sum of dollars that the shipyard said that they needed to carry it out. And where he made his big mistake was taking this list of things to be done and applying his own judgment as to how much each of these items was going to cost, so he came out with the total that the shipyard had come out with. And there was the famous case of the cabin mirrors, which were going to cost $100 to replace or something, and the chairs in the briefing room were going to cost $100 to lift up and put back again, and so on. It turned out that those figures were way out of line. They bore no cost to reality. But on the other hand, there were other things that cost a lot more than had been forecast. Like when you made an estimate of what you were going to spend on the machinery, you didn't have the machinery opened up to see. You only knew that you were going to open it up. So in a lot of areas, they spent a lot more money than probably had been assumed by this project officer. And in other areas, they spent a lot less than was necessary. So no one cheated anyone, really. But it would have been better if they had just taken the shipyard's estimate and got on with it and just policed the job to make sure that none of the money was spent on something that wasn't essential to the ship, rather than trying to relate it all to a hypothetical breakdown, which had no basis in fact. And it wasn't until the investigation was well underway that it was discovered that this was just how the thing had come about, and this was the source of the problem. And by this time, faces were red all over the place, And the Bonaventure was a scandal in the newspapers every day. Also, integration had taken place. Some of the masters in Ottawa weren't at all inclined to be spending money on naval aviation anyway. And so it didn't take much persuading for the Department of National Defense to agree with the public that the Bonaventure was a waste of money and should have been got rid of. In fact, it wasn't a waste of money. It would have served as well if it had continued in being. But I think it's worth making a note of that, because that is the... And I don't mean to imply that the young gentleman who put that list together to send to the Treasury Board was doing anything wrong. I think it had been the practice all along. He was just following what had been the practice. In fact, he was quite a bright young man, as I recall. He had left a very promising career in the Navy to go and work for the Department of Defense Production. So, that's just an aside to do with the Bonaventure.
No, that's good, because it cleans up that particular ship, I guess. It was a great tragedy, all the same. I agree that
it was.
They got rid of her. So that brings it to what, 57?
Yes, I left the ship in the summer of 57 and was appointed to Ottawa, again to a job in the Engineer-in-Chief's Department, somewhat akin to the job that I'd had before, but it had been reorganized a bit. But basically, I had a lot of the same people on my staff that I'd had previously. And I think in this case, I was called the Senior Assistant Engineer-in-Chief. And there was a deputy engineer-in-chief who was a captain. And my position was to be a captain's position, too, although I didn't actually get promoted to captain until I was about halfway through the job. They used the billet to offset a job somewhere else. While I was in that job, we worked on a number of... new ship designs, none of which really ever came to fruition. But I wasn't there all that long. So I don't think there's anything very special that needs to be said about that period, 57 to 59, because we didn't, in fact, launch much in the way of new programs. We were working hard on a thing called the General Purpose Frigate.
Right, that's what I asked you about that.
Yeah. And we worked on that very hard right up until the next time the government changed, then the General Purpose Frigate got canceled. And
specifically, why was it canceled? Financial or what?
I don't really know. It reminds me very much of the argument that's going on now between the federal government and Alberta over oil. I mean, it's just what one government agrees to, another government feels obliged to not agree to. And I think there was a lot of that in it.
It's a shame. We would have certainly be a great deal better off from the sea element if we'd gone ahead with that program, I should think.
Yes, I think so. It was a good program. It was a good ship design, and we worked very hard on it. And we were planning to use all these facilities that I've described earlier.
Yeah.
We were keeping those all warm, ready to go again, fighting off the people who wanted to have them scrapped and so on. But when I left Ottawa again in September of 1960, we were still working on the fragments of the... Mind you, we were still also completing the tail end of the new ship programs that had been started in the early 50s. I mean, the last of the gate vessels and minesweepers and miscellaneous ships that were being built back then didn't finish until 59-60. I was promoted to captain, and I think it was July the 1st, 1959, after I'd been in that job about a year. And I served in it for another year. But one of the two interesting things were going on. We were studying the question of going into the nuclear submarine business. then.
Before you go into that, I wonder if you could just a little bit more about this. There's one question about the general purpose frigate.
Mm-hmm.
Was it exclusively a Canadian design?
Yes.
Different than the Saint Laurent, the Restigouche, and that sort of class.
Yes, it was. It was exclusively Canadian. We were going to incorporate in it as many features of the equipment and from the Saint Laurent Restigouche as was still current, but we were trying to make a leap forward into the next generation of electronics and that sort of thing.
The general purpose part of it, of course, implies that it's not strictly an anti-submarine vessel. And,
yeah.
Was heavier guns and this sort of thing, or missiles, or what?
Yes, guns and missiles, and anti-submarine. The idea was that there was always a lot of criticism that Canada shouldn't be exclusively an anti-submarine navy. It should be more a general purpose, that we should be able to provide peacekeeping forces, in the Middle East and elsewhere, and that we should have ships that were adaptable to other types of thing. And I think our destroyers in the Korean War had, they were employed shooting up trains and things of that nature.
Right.
So.
That's
the type of thing I think it was meant by general purpose. And, of course, the feasibility of carrying helicopters was certainly under review then as well. So they would have been anti-submarine, but with an air flavor to them in addition.
Yeah. The change of government certainly scuppered that anyway.
Stopped it dead, yes. But not until 1961, I guess.
Uh-huh.
Was that when the change of government came about?
Well,
61,
yeah. Was still in 61.
It was...
But, then he was defeated, I think, and came back as a minority government for a short time.
Yeah.
And Pearson took over about 63 or
so. I don't think that's quite... dates, but however, let's not get too bogged down on dates.
Okay. You were looking at nuclear subs.
Yes, we were. And we formed in Ottawa a thing called the Nuclear Submarine Survey Team. And it was headed by Captain Davis and Captain, or maybe it was Commander Stevens then. Later Vice Admiral, and Commander Christie, who later became a Rear Admiral, and so on. They had a very select group. I'm not so sure that Commander Nixon, who's now the Deputy Minister, I think he was also a member of the team. I don't remember all the names, but I believe he was one of them. They were a very select group. And I mentioned earlier that my position as my captain's position in the job I was in was the one that was used to cover off Captain Davis in this survey team, because it was a team that was formed but there was no establishment to cover it. And they spent about a year visiting Washington and elsewhere, England, looking at what was going on in the nuclear field. And all of the other people in headquarters who would have had responsibility if some nuclear submarines had been built were party to this study in some, to a greater or lesser extent. So I, as the kind of head mechanical engineer, had some input into it, and I personally went off and did a little studying about nuclear energy and so on in England and Chalk River, and just getting acquainted. Anyway, they produced a very fine report, and it did recommend getting into the nuclear submarine business, but it never happened. But there was a lot of effort went into that study during that period on the part of everybody.
Was this before or after we got our three submarines?
This is before. We got the Oberon submarines quite a bit later. I'll come to those later on.
I wonder if this had anything to do with it, that's all. You can't have nukes, but you can have regular conventional.
Well, I think one was an outgrowth of the other. When it was decided we weren't going to have any nukes, we got the Oberons.
Mm-hmm.
I think the father of the Oberons was undoubtedly Admiral Welland, who I think was around when they were bought and selected and modified and so on. I had responsibility for them while they were building at Chatham, indirectly, later on in a in a later appointment. But in the summer of fall of 1960, I was selected to go to the National Defense College. And as you know, there was usually three senior officers from each of the three services, and three or four from, or maybe up to 10, from other government departments. Three military from United States, three military from Britain, and one or two foreign office people from the United States and from Britain, as well as two or three external affairs people from our own. It's a class of 30 altogether,
mm-hmm.
and we were there for a year. You probably have interviewed other people about the National Defense College, so I won't.
Everybody has different experiences.
But it was a very fine experience. It was really a course. I think it's misnamed to just be called the National Defense College, because it really is a course in political science or in geopolitics, and nothing more, nothing less. And the tours and everything we took were exactly that. They were political in nature. We were briefed by senior government officials just everywhere. We usually met the prime minister if he was at home. Half the time when you arrived, the prime minister was visiting some other head of state, and you didn't get to see him, but I remember we did get to see,
it was an enjoyable appointment for anybody who went there. Because
I remember spending half a day with Kwame Nkrumah as the prime minister of Ghana, who subsequently was dethroned because he made the mistake of leaving the country for a weekend or something. But we were well received similarly in Belgrade and Rome and Athens. And in Kenya, I remember being told by the people who briefed us in Kenya that Mr. Kenyatta was in jail and was never going to be let out. But later on, he was let out.
Didn't work out too well. That prediction did.
So on. Without going into the details, it was that sort of experience we had, and it was extremely worthwhile. They divided the course into two groups for the purpose of tours, and usually one group went to the Far East and the other group went to Europe, and my group went to Europe and Africa. The only unfortunate part was we were assigned a North Star airplane to take us around, and a noisier machine has never been built.
No.
A more infernal device has never been designed by man, but I didn't
realize they were still flying at 1960. I suppose they were. Yeah.
No, they were indeed. And I remember flying from Accra in Ghana to Nairobi in Kenya all in one day. And that's like flying from, I guess, Victoria to St. John, Newfoundland or something.
Good Lord, yeah.
With one fuel stop at a wretched place called Bangui in the middle of French West Equatorial Africa, I guess. And that was the longest day ever put in. We left our hotel, I think, at about 5 in the morning. We arrived at a hotel in Nairobi about 10 or 11 at night, and our ears were just pounding from the sound, and it was hot. But enjoyed that tremendously. I highly recommend that course. I think it was well designed, well run, and everything about it was well done.
Just one question about it. Had you representatives from industry there was quite a time of trouble getting
we didn't have any representatives from industry on my course. We didn't have any women. Mm-hmm. Later on, Miss Flora MacDonald, who became the Minister of External Affairs, became the first woman student, but she was there 7 or 8 years after I was, I think. I remember going back in 1972, I think it was, for the 25th anniversary of the existence of the college, and Flora MacDonald was a member of the class that was going through at that time, whereas I'd gone through 11 years earlier, I guess. And they did get people from industry as well later on. I think the problem was convincing industry that it was worth spending $40,000 or $50,000 or whatever the cost of maintaining a senior executive was for a year,
losing his
services and so on.
Yeah.
Is anybody that's sort of worth the kind of money that anybody of the quality that he wanted to send there. It was also terribly valuable for his firm.
Yeah, right.
But I think some of the oil companies did send people eventually. I know, having been to shorter courses, like management courses at Banff, industry plunged into those wholeheartedly and sent some very good people to them. So I think it was just the length of time that was the problem, mm-hmm. not the principle.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Just a word about the people who were there. Rear Admiral Storrs was the commandant. Commodore Stirling was the naval member. He later became a Rear Admiral, now lives in Victoria. The external affairs member was Mr. George Kidd, who has recently retired as ambassador to Nigeria, and he's living here in Victoria, in the uplands. And the army member was a Brigadier Knight, who I believe is living in New Brunswick or somewhere else. I believe they're all still around. Oh, the Air Force member was Air Commodore Peter Gouin, G-O-U-I-N. And I believe he's still in Ottawa. And I think when he retired, he took a job with representing some industry or other with an aircraft flavor. I'm not sure, though. I haven't really seen him. So that finishes the National Defense College.
How far we get? Okay.
When I finished the National Defense College in the summer of 1961, I again went back to Ottawa and again became the senior engineer in chief, and the job had not changed really in the year that I was away. However, I don't think it had been the intention that I was going to stay in that job particularly long. And I'd only been there a few months when Captain John Summers, who was the principal naval overseer at Canadian Vickers in Montreal, rather suddenly died. And so I was sent to replace him in the middle of the winter, January, I think it was, to Montreal. And I became, for the next 3 years, the principal naval overseer in the Montreal area. That was a job whose responsibilities embraced all the supervision of all the military technical activities that went on in Montreal. Had an office at Canadian Vickers, but I had responsibility for the naval engineering test plant at Peacock's on the other side of town, the naval gearing plant on the other side of town, and several other minor things. The responsibility for supervising the activities of the Naval Central Drawing Office, not managing it, but inspecting its output and coordinating the input to it. And I was chairman of the management committee of the Naval Central Drawing Office. But I'd hardly arrived in Montreal when some other funny circumstances occurred. The Commodore Plummer, who had been the... No, that's not right. The naval controller was suddenly moved. He was a rear admiral, and I've forgotten who it was now. Perhaps it just simply retired. Because Admiral Wright had been, I think, the naval controller, and he retired.
That Tony Wright is here?
Tony Wright,
yeah. Okay.
And there was great controversy over who was going to replace him. And Commodore Plummer, who had been his deputy, expected to replace him and didn't. And he then retired and wrote a nasty article later on in Maclean's magazine about the... I think the old school tie and the pre World War II RCM and so on, but be that as it may, I don't want to get involved in that. But they decided that the successor to the controller would be Commodore Dillon, who was at that time in Montreal as the naval as the senior naval officer, St. Lawrence River area. And he had responsibilities for supply depot and the supply school at HMCS Hochelaga, and for seeing and visiting ships and ships making passage through the St. Lawrence and so on were properly attended to. And he had two jobs. He had one job as the senior naval officer, St. Lawrence River area, with an office downtown in the federal government building on Dorchester Street. And he had then had another office, another job as naval officer in charge of Montreal, which meant that he was really just responsible for personnel matters and things in the Montreal area, and the supply depot and things came under that hat. And as naval officer in charge, he had an office at the supply depot in in Ville LaSalle. So I ended up with three offices 14 miles from apart. One at Canadian Vickers, one at Ville LaSalle, and one downtown. And I wore three hats for the next 2 years, I think it was. And spent more time in the back seat of a staff car than I care to imagine. And I stayed in Montreal until 1964. I did take a little time off, went to Banff for 6 weeks in the middle of the winter to the Banff School of Advanced Management. Enjoyed the course there very much. And back to Montreal.
There wasn't any really large construction going on there at that time.
No, well, the GP frigate, when I first arrived, we were still working on the drawings for that.
Yeah.
And it was while I was there that it got canceled, the GP frigate. That's why I think it was sometime early 61, because I hadn't been there very long. And but what we were doing, there was no big construction, but we were doing some ship modernizations there, and we did one ship modernization or two while I was there. But the big job was supervising this Naval Central Drawing Office. As I said before, the tail end of the 205 class, 257 class, you know, Saint-Laurent Restigouche, there were two of those ships that were, three equipped to carry helicopters. And one was built in Halifax, one in Vickers, and one at Sorel. And so the one that was building at Vickers was still building when I arrived there to be P&O.
Okay,
yeah. And it was just being finished. And we had a destroyer refit or two while we were there. There were always ships coming in for refit. We were doing those. So I was fairly busy, but mainly the job was looking after ship refits.
Were you involved with the design or the construction of what's it called, Bear Claw, the haul down system for the helicopter?
Yeah, but yes, there and elsewhere. When the GP frigate was canceled, then we moved on to what became the DDH 280 class, and I became very involved in that. And later on, had complete responsibility for the DDH 280 class and for anything else that was building. But that's a year or two later.
Yeah.
Life went on pretty well in a routine way in Montreal between 61 and 64. And as I said, we had various ships coming in for refit and minor repairs, and we were working like mad on drawings and so on. 1964, Mr. Hellier was the minister, and he decided on integration. And in the summer, or late summer, I think, of 1964, they began putting together integration teams to study the whole question. And I found myself being yanked from Montreal to go to Ottawa to be a member of one of these integration study teams. And this was a very on-again, off-again thing. I don't know whether you'd like me to get into the whole subject of integration
yeah,
here or not.
Yeah.
Well, that'll probably take us for the next half hour. Mr. Hellyer had put together a very short study team under his own supervision, I think, to decide whether integration was feasible and so on, and they came up with a very sketchy outline, which I think he took and modified with his own fair hand, and finally one day announced that integration was going to be proceeded with. I mentioned integration, not unification.
Mm-hmm.
And he then started out by personally selecting the team of about five or six that were going to head, were going to staff the headquarters, as it were, and without really relating to the organization. In other words, he created the heads and then built the organization under them rather than building the organization first and creating the heads afterwards.
Okay.
And this made life a little frustrating because he decided on his own that there would be a chief of defense staff, I think, and a deputy chief of defense staff, and that there would be a chief of personnel, chief of technical services, a controller general, and I guess that was basically it. The controller general, chief of technical services, chief of personnel, and the vice chief of defense staff were the big four. If there was a fourth, another one, I'll think of it later. And so he named those people and said, now you go away and develop your organization. And I was appointed to the staff of the gentleman who was named to be the chief of technical services. And right away, he in turn formed two study groups under himself, one for logistics and the other for engineering, I think. And more than that, one for logistics, one for engineering, one for telecommunications, and one for construction. By construction, I mean works and buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So right away, before any study groups had had a chance to do anything, it had been decided that there was going to be four or five arms to the thing,
yeah.
Which wasn't necessarily the logical way to do it. And but it was too late to fight, you know. For instance, without being parochial, we had always combined the same engineers who specified the design of machinery also monitored the operation of it and dealt with problems as they rose in the field later on. In other words, you didn't have two separate groups of experts and everything. But it wasn't to be any longer. We had to have one group dealing with engineering and development, I guess it was, which is while things were building, and another group dealing with things in being, and to have two sets of experts. To make matters worse, the group that were going to deal with the things in being were destined to move to Rockcliffe instead of defense headquarters. So we had a materiel command at Rockcliffe, and they were responsible for things in being, and the people in headquarters were responsible for bringing things into being. And so that stretched the experts no end and caused all sorts of fighting over who would get the bodies.
Yeah.
And even when you divided up the bodies, still lots of fighting as to where the responsibility for one aspect left off and the other one began. So it wasn't an easy thing to do at all. And I found myself, having been appointed to the job because I had declared myself in favor of integration, and